I'm going to introduce Tony Gosling. He's quite great, thanks, he's here. Tony Gosling, everybody. Right, thank you, Andy. Now, just to tell you a bit about my background, worked for a few years after school, did a humanities degree, worked for a few years after that in a family business, which is in aviation. And I think one of the, I suppose, two or three years working on an airfield in Biggin Hill, in just near south-east London, it's one of those things that the background of which really made me question a lot of the stuff that was coming out immediately after the September 11th attacks happened. A lot of these things that we were being told about what had been happening on that day, particularly to do with the complete failure of the US Air Force to react, it seems, apart from the Shanksville plane. This really made me question it, although I didn't really do a lot about it at the time and waited until some of the films had come out. So I worked in aviation for a while, then went on to work at the BBC doing really just researcher at the Greater London Radio, which is a massive station which we were working on documentaries and also on the Drive Time show, which was a pretty high-paced news programme which went out all over London. I suppose something like 10 million potential listeners. We had a massive audience, Greater London Radio. And we were dealing with news stories in London, which were, a lot of which were international stories. Very few local radio stations had the kind of editorial content that we had in London. After the BBC experience, which was about nearly 4 years, working also in some other local radio stations and working my way up to as a reporter, then went on to get involved in environmental campaigning with something called The Land Is Ours, which was to do with land ownership and land rights, taking over pieces of land, squatting, and really showing the way land should be used rather than for things like another supermarket. And then really since then, I've got back into journalism as a freelancer and doing all sorts of other stuff as well. But mainly now, I suppose, concentrating on a weekly programme in Bristol, which is a two-hour show on community radio, which is a politics show. And actually what we're trying to do with that show is do something that the BBC and the other stations in the city in Bristol aren't just simply not doing, which is to really give the politicians... you can all boo now if you want. The politicians, a proper run-out. Because when they go on to most of the local radio and television, they will get maybe on the TV, maybe a minute and a half at the most. On the radio, maybe 3 minutes at the most at all. So we give them a whole hour. And also, we're running past them from time to time some of the big questions that you ask in these sorts of gatherings, which are the sorts of questions that a lot of the mainstream media, if not 99% of it, just simply avoids because it's too awkward to ask those questions. And I want to talk tonight largely about the media and about the way that what we get through our mainstream press in this country has changed so much over the last 30, 40 years and is a really distorted picture of the outside world. We like to think of the press as reflecting what's going on in society. That's what it's there to do. But it's becoming an institution which is literally telling us what to think. And I think this is one of the reasons we get so fed up. I mean, people can probably remember the film about... gosh, I can't even remember the name of it, but it's with that Guy Fawkes character, I'm sure someone will tell me now. Yes. Where there's a little child screams at the television, saying, you know, you don't expect us to believe that crap, do you? And that's how I feel, I'm sure you do, a lot of the time now in this country. Yeah. It's the sort of thing we were spun as kids as a kind of Soviet-style press, where the press, the media, actually talks down to you and is trying to tell you what to think. Actually, as a nation, we're not like that. This is why people are actually leaving, particularly young people, the television news off and getting their news from other sources, like, you know, most importantly, obviously, the internet, which has been a real revolution over the last, 15 years or so. So I'm also doing selling documentaries online, so I've got a little sort of sideline business. Things like the Battle of the Beanfield, if people know about the way the Travellers were attacked by Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. And the other one we sell quite a lot of is something called the Battle of Trafalgar, which is a fantastic documentary made for Channel 4 about what actually really happened at the poll tax riots. What that documentary does is it shows you, contrasts the footage which was released that evening and during the day with actual footage from on the ground in Trafalgar Square. And what Mark Saunders, the producer of that, has done with it is he was there, he saw this riot unfolding, and he had the presence of mind to go around getting phone numbers for everyone he could see with a video camera, or back in those days, there were only a few video cameras around, but he got the phone numbers for everybody who was shooting film and video footage there, also stills photographers. And he painstakingly, over 3 or 4 months after the riots, put together a documentary that showed the lies that were being told by the mainstream press at the time to try and blame the riots on the demonstrators. He managed to show conclusively, and it's quite a shocking film, that it was the police that deliberately provoked the riot through driving a police van into the crowd. And it was the way that was spun that is so shocking about that film. So that's another thing. I'm also involved in the National Union of Journalists, which I joined about 10, 15 years ago. And as a union, I mean, I think we're still valid today. The BBC, for example, we've had a whole series of disputes over probably the last 3 or 4 years, the latest of which is over compulsory redundancies. And let me just explain a little bit about, I mean, the first dispute was over a whole load of changes that the BBC wanted to make to contracts. And after 2 years of negotiations with fathers of chapel and mothers of chapel from right across the country, and our union officials, negotiating with BBC management, eventually every single one of those demands by the BBC management was dropped. That's a strong union. And also, the most recent changes that the BBC are trying to do is obviously it's part of the cuts, which largely is a government sop to Murdoch, saying that actually that the BBC is going to have to be pared down because it's unfair competition to Rupert Murdoch. I mean, we're none of us are the total fans of the BBC, but there are some really good people working in there, doing their best in a kind of Maginot line, you know, from behind the bunkers. And the changes recently, what they're trying to do is sack people. What's happened is the union has got together, this is journalists, the people, our eyes and ears, the union has got together and spoken to everybody that's potentially going to be made redundant. Now, what they've done is they've come up with a list of people who are prepared to take voluntary redundancy, and what they're saying is just swap the jobs around a little bit and nobody needs to be made compulsory redundant, but the BBC are having none of it. This is why the negotiation of the dispute is still going on right now. The reason for this is that the management are actually targeting individuals for their political views and for their courage. The journalists who are the most courageous are the ones that have been targeted with compulsory redundancy. So you can see that maybe what's going on behind the scenes and how important the trade union, the National Union of Journalists, still is in Britain, and actually allowing us to see what's really going on. It's a bit of a bunker mentality, and the battles that we see on the television in Afghanistan and Iraq are echoed within our newsrooms around the country as there are attempts to force courageous journalists out of their jobs onto the dole queue. So anyway, we've come today, I suppose, really to talk about just about the press. I mean, this is what I wanted to talk to you about, some of the techniques used to manipulate the media. John Dewey is a philosopher from, I think it was American, Martin, you might remind me. His famous quote is, "Education is a system of imposed ignorance." One of his famous quotes. And I think this is really an important thing to remember, because certainly the way we get taught our history in school in Britain is very, very selective. There's all sorts of things that they don't really want to tell us about. I mean, one of the large things is to do with the attacks on the Irish over the centuries, and the whole of Irish history. Really, you need to go somewhere else other than Britain to learn about it. It's not taught to us in British schools unless you want to maybe speak to an Irish person over here. And it's quite gobsmacking sometimes to realise that you thought you knew a bit about history and you don't. But in a way, journalism is a sort of running history lesson, because a lot of the stuff that we're getting at the moment, for example, to do with wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the Middle East, contains a take on history, which is also slanted. So in a way, journalists are the sort of teachers for people who've left school in a funny kind of fashion. I think, I hope you're following, well, I hope I'm making sense in a way. Another thing is, if you look at the entire nation or the entire world as one kind of body, you know, I'm not really going too much into this whole Gaia thing, but the media is our nervous system. The media is our brain. And what better prize for a ruthless, greedy elite than to control that nervous system? They then would be able to, hopefully anyway, control the way we think, the way we react to things, and almost set triggers in our minds to react in certain ways to certain things. And I think that's what's going on with the way that the media is being controlled. In a way, the media is kind of like a nuclear weapon. In that, you'd have heard that expression, the pen is mightier than the sword. Those who like war and fighting and use this to get what they want realise that the modern, particularly broadcast media, is more powerful than they are, and they're scared to death that it will be telling the truth to people. So it's important for them to control the way that outlet of information and news is disseminated. Otherwise, we might rumble them, and they may not get what they want. You know, because the pen is mightier. Should we say the keyboard is mightier than the sword, or than the nuclear weapon, or whatever? So there's a tension there between people that want to use force and also people that want to actually understand what's going on in the world, so that maybe that force won't be used, or that somebody's bluff will be called. I think also, you can't talk about the media without talking about taboos. Because the most important thing, is that there is a whole load of subjects which are just totally out of bounds for the press to discuss. I mean, I came across this myself, even simply talking about homelessness at Greater London Radio, saying that I've met some homeless people I wanted to do a piece on the radio about homelessness. I was told by an editor, well, no one's interested in that. It's not sexy enough. Hang on, homelessness is like one of the most important things that's going on in London. You know, people having to sleep out in doorways. Isn't this something that actually affects more people? And also potentially lots of people who have got homes. So there are taboos, and I would say probably the most important two things which are misrepresented by the press, or not at all, are land and money. I mean, this is one of the reasons I've got into this environmental campaign, is just understanding how the land has been stolen from us over the centuries. Land is whether you believe in God or not, a land is a free gift to mankind. We all need it for somewhere to have a home. We all need it for recreation, to go for a walk. And we all need the resources the land gives us. Everybody needs that. And so in any sort of basic civilised society, you would think land, everybody would have a right to it. In fact, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it's absolutely clear after the Second World War, everyone has the right to shelter. Everyone. Mm. Now we're in a situation in this country where this government is talking about criminalising squatting and saying that it's impossible, even if a house has been empty for 10 years, that you're not allowed to go in there and actually get a roof over your head for the night. There's all sorts of really nasty stuff been coming out in the Daily Mail over the last few months about how these squatters are intentionally homeless. And actually, what's happening is our financial system is failing us, and thousands of people every month are actually having their homes repossessed. What are they supposed to do? Our councils are unable to house people these days. They're not building any council houses. Just in Bristol, where I happen to know the figures, we've got over 20,000 people on the housing list waiting for somewhere to live. So squatting is an obvious, this is the market, isn't it? We've got loads of empty buildings. We've got loads of people that need them. Just put two and two together. And the land has been stolen over the centuries, basically through something called enclosure, which was privatisation of land. And this has been done by a parliament, which only people who owned land were allowed to vote up until 150 years ago or so. Only people who owned land. So this was a landowner's parliament kicking people off the land because they could make more profit out of sheep than they could out of rents from individuals on the land. So that's one thing you don't see really discussed very much in the mainstream media, because it's another piece of history which has been erased. The other thing is money, and the way money over the years, because of course once you've made people homeless by taking their land away, they are then totally reliant on a money system to feed their families, to feed themselves, and to live. And so the way that the money system is set up as a kind of private trap to get people is also not explained. The battle has been over the years for the control of money on the private interests on the one hand, and from the treasuries and the government interests on this hand. So I mean, you know, if people have ever come across Bill Still, I don't know if anyone here has seen any of his films. He did one called The Money Masters, which is very long and very detailed. And he did also one much more recently called The Secret of Oz. But Bill has really gone into, I think, explains it better than anyone else I've seen, that the way that the money system, they've first privatised the land, and then the elite have then privatised the money system. So we are totally reliant on them at this point, for the money, because we're landless. Now, okay, a bit about distortion in the press. There's a lot of the law that we have to learn as journalists, things like the Official Secrets Act. This often means that anything that might be something covered by the Official Secrets Act, journalists simply tiptoe around it. It's just too much trouble. If someone comes to them with a story, an ex-soldier, their immediate thoughts are, well, we can have a chat down the pub, but I'm sorry, I can't convert this into a story in the newspaper. It's going to be far too much hassle. Lawyers are expensive. Also, what your editor may well want is just for you to fill as much of the page space as possible. This is what happens nowadays. I mean, there are some notable exceptions, some principal national papers. For example, The Guardian printing some very brave stories to do with the phone hacking. And there are other examples. But generally speaking, the idea of a journalist nowadays is that you sit at a terminal, you don't leave the building, and you just simply fill up as much space as you possibly can in the shortest possible time. Now, that does not include stories which rock the boat, like an Official Secrets story, where in preparation for the story, the editor may get a call from the Denoters Committee or somebody else, or from simply a Ministry of Defence lawyer saying, we noticed that you were doing this. We think it would be a very bad idea if you published it, or getting potentially even an injunction to stop. Now, that means that journalist has been working maybe for 2 or 3 days on a story, and it actually isn't going to go anywhere. So these are some of the reasons why difficult legal stories aren't touched or tiptoed around. And if you talk to particularly local newspaper journalists nowadays, they will tell you a lot of their time is spent simply cutting and pasting press releases into a newspaper, which any child could do, a monkey could do. And then those pages are then just edited by someone does a page, they are a graphic designer, and a lot of their work is simply getting through as much material as possible that's easy and not controversial. So the other thing is there's something called the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. Has anyone here ever heard of them? Yeah? Because they're a fantastic little organisation. They do, for I think £6 a year, they do a newsletter that comes out once every 2 months, and it gives you a whole insight into some of the things that are going on behind the scenes to do with media ownership. They have a chart, which they update every few years, of all the big media. There's 5 big media companies in the world. And how those have changed. There's Bertelsmann is a massive media company, for example, that owned Channel 5 for quite a long time. One of the things that you don't often hear is that Bertelsmann was the German firm that published Mein Kampf, for example. And they are now one of the 5 biggest media corporations in the world. And of course, they don't just publish books or own TV channels. They also own whole rafts of magazines in magazine publishing. They're doing radio, they're doing newspapers, and to a large extent, these organisations are growing in a quite frightening fashion because they're doing cross-fertilisation between these different media. They're plugging their books on the television, they're plugging their magazines on the TV or on the radio, and they're doing a lot of, really, which is just simply cross-marketing from one to another. Now, that whole situation is getting worse and worse because the small guys cannot compete with these big 5. They're just being snapped up like little fishes being eaten by sharks. All the small people in the business are finding that there are immense pressures on them, either to sell up or have you know, have hostile takeover. So this is the situation we're in with these the five big companies in US and Europe that run our press. And the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom is one of the only organisations in the country, if not in Europe, which is really keeping track of what's going on and giving them a hard time. So they're well worth knowing about. The other side of all this is advertising and how that affects what we see. I'll start off though with an exception to the rule, which is RTE. Do people know, does anyone here listen to RTE?
Yeah.
The Irish broadcaster.
Yeah,
RTE1 is actually really quite good. You know, if you want to listen to a slightly different angle on the world news, listen to RTE1. They're on long wave. I think it's 252 long wave. You can pick them up quite well here. But the east of Britain, not, you can't pick them up so well. But they have a very good system right from day one set up with advertising. That is to say, their advertising section is totally separate to the editorial. There's absolutely no way that the advertising companies that advertise on RTE can affect anything to do with the editorial process. That is to say, what's in the news. Because this is a serious problem in other parts of the media. The advertisers call the shots to a large extent when you're talking about a big company like, say, Mercedes, that has a contract with, say, The Guardian, spending something like £12-13 million a year on block ads that they will take throughout the year. The threat that contract will be taken away can be a massive incentive on an editor to say, actually, I think we should back away from that story. Imagine, you know, how would that sit, a BMW advert, for example, next to last week's story about BMW and forced labour, and how the family, the Quant family that owned BMW, used, I think it was 50,000 slave labourers in World War II, and that's how they made their money to buy BMWs. Would that sit next to a BMW advert nicely? So the advertising in RTE is one of the only places I've ever come across where they've made a formal, complete separation between advertising and the actual news content. Think also about programmes on the television like Grand Designs. Grand Designs, you know, we might like to watch it. It's sort of old-fashioned buildings. I take it most people have seen this show where people kind of go and build a new building, their dream home. Grand Designs is actually aimed at a very high-end market for advertisers. This is the kind of thing the advertisers love, because the people that will, never mind about the rest of us, but this programme appeals to the people who have a fantastic amount of disposable income in our society generally. And those are the people that the advertisers want to reach. So Grand Designs, as it rolls out on More4, can be guaranteed to pull in just the right kind of advertising, or at least a lot of money for the advertiser. But actually, a lot of it is aspirational for you and me, probably. You know, I'm never going to buy a massive mansion and do it. It's all just looking on, well, maybe one day I could buy this. I was chatting to Martin about this earlier on. This is like Dallas. It's like our aspirational. Let's look at way things could be maybe one day. And it's actually quite horrible. Every time I see Grand Designs, I find it, look, there's something sick about this. What you're doing is you're doing a great show about something which most people will never ever be able to afford to do. They can just wish, maybe do the lottery, you know. And I find that sort of, the way that the content is decided in media boardrooms based around, we want to have something that the advertisers will want to have a TV advert on. I find that horrible. You know, we should be deciding on content based on what affects people. What is going to affect people in the years to come? What actually touches people's lives in a big way? That's how we should decide. And if you go to journalism college, that's what they tell you. You know, you look at a news bulletin, and that news bulletin should have at the top of it the story which affects people the most. The most people, the most. And down the news bulletin, it should be stories that affect people less and less, maybe. And maybe some silly story at the end. That's the sort of tradition, isn't it? You have some kind of bogus silly story at the end about a dog or whatever. Just as a sideline, I used to work on a phone-in down at Radio Solent in Southampton. I did that for about a year. And it was just incredible to see what would actually elicit the most phone calls. And that was silly stories like that about pets. And you get thousands of phone calls. And yet, when I was working down there, it was when there was the very first day of the first Gulf War in 1991, the invasion of Kuwait. And Portsmouth's very close to us, it's a military town. We decided we were going to do a discussion in the morning on the phone-in all about the war. And the producer I worked with was a fantastic woman. She had printed a typed out a script for the presenter, who was the girl that presented The South Today, which was the BBC's TV thing in the evening. She was on our radio station in the morning doing a phone discussion, so everyone kind of knew who she was. And she read out this thing saying, oh, people phone in, could people just phone in? Tell us what you think about this war. Is it the right thing to do? Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, as she read this, what we always did was we would play a bit of music. She'd read out the script, introducing the topic for people to phone in about. And let's just start with the little bit of music. And at that point, the music went on. You see the lights all starting to light up as people start to phone in, and we filter through the calls. Anyone, you know, you always get one person who phoned in every week, every morning, the same kind of, just tell them to go away or politely. But that morning, nothing happened, right? I was sitting there, and I turned to the producer, and I said, what the hell's going on? Are there someone jamming our phone lines, or what? And she looked at me, and she said, well, actually, no, we just haven't told them what to think yet. She didn't say it in a nasty way. She was saying in an ironic, you know, look, actually, maybe, you know, because it's, you know, it's quite a big topic. We're going to war this morning. And what she did is she got a typewriter. It was the days before even Amstrad computers. She got a typewriter. Typed this script out really quickly. I ran it through into the presenter just as the music was finishing. She read this script, which was saying things like, have you got someone who's in the forces now? Are you worried about them? Have you ever been to that part of the world? Tell us if you've ever been to the Middle East. You know, what do you think? And she was on a whole load of sort of triggers saying what you might think. And as the presenter was reading the script out, I was just gobsmacked as the phone line started lighting up. Bop, 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 bop. And we had a big audience there, a whole of Southampton and Portsmouth and our sort of all surrounding areas we were covering. So you can see that there is this kind of, especially with things that are far away. If it's in your own backyard, we know what to think about it. But so much of what we've seen here today, particularly in the mass media, is something we never have any direct experience of. We're really trusting the press. And this is why it's so important that our press tells the truth about what's going on in other parts of the world. Another example of that is Michael Meacher in The Guardian, this is about a couple of years after the whole 9/11 business, did an article saying, this war on terror is bogus, in The Guardian. Check it, it's on the website still, just about. This war on terror is bogus. Now, I knew a guy in London who works for the Guardian advertising department, and he told me that they had several big institutions phone in. That same day that article came out, to say to the Guardian, we're pulling our advertising. And it was nearly £1 million worth of advertising was pulled that same day that article went into The Guardian. So you can see we've got a fundamental flaw in our media. It's actually the people with the money call the shots about content. Now, there's a certain amount of room for manoeuvre, and there certainly has been during the phone hacking business, but there's a real problem in the things which are really controversial, which hit a nerve amongst the international elite. You may well find your paper will go under if you print that story. And that's a big decision for an editor to have to make. However good-hearted the editor might be, you know, he's shaking his head saying, we can't do this. Remember what happened last time. So that shouldn't be like that, but it is. The other thing is self-censorship, which is just fear of losing your job. Now, in this financial situation, largely, a lot of our newspapers are very de-unionised. A lot of them had to fight for recognition over the last 10 years or so to actually get union recognition, to actually force the management to negotiate with the union when they've got, I think it's 60% of the staff are actually in the union. Then you have to do a legal fight with the management to actually get them, force them to recognise the union. It's a divide and rule policy where as soon as journalists start rocking the boat, talking about things that they don't want to talk about, they'll find themselves either just their contracts not renewed or they're constructively dismissed. So this is fear and self-censorship. This plays a major part in journalists' activity, is that they just want to keep their job, they want to pay the mortgage. And you can kind of understand why that is. If you're in that situation, you know, how principled are you going to be? You're going to ruin your career by saying something which you know is going to upset your boss, or even trying to put an article in the newspaper. You may write something and get spiked. You might submit that story, and it never sees the light of day. It's just that somebody somewhere, one of your managers, knows that you wrote that story and he's out to get you. You're in a box marked trouble, and you're bullied, and eventually constructively dismissed or whatever. So self-censorship is a way of journalists just trying to keep their jobs by not rocking the boat. And that, a large part of that is to do with the mass pool, massive number of people that want to be journalists. Kids, you know, straight out of media college, just got a media degree, they're banging on the door trying to do those jobs that journalists have been doing for years. So this is another way in which people don't necessarily write about or say what they really want to say. Now, just to give you another example, we were talking about the BBC a bit earlier, but Paul Mason, for example, on Newsnight, is in a reasonably strong position in his job. Not only is he very well respected, and people have come across his work, I mean, most of you, I imagine, would have seen Paul Mason on Newsnight doing his economic coverage. He is also the father of Chapel, that's what we call the union organising in the BBC and in other media places, the Chapel. He's the father of Chapel at the BBC Television Centre. So when somebody's having trouble with their manager as part of their job at the BBC, Paul Mason is the guy they're going to have a chat with to say, can we not get this sorted out? So he's basically like a union shop steward for BBC Television. Very few people realise that. Another thing is sport. Sport. I mean, a lot of us love sport, but sport is being used as like a Trojan horse. People listen to Radio 5 Live. I listen to it quite a bit. And on 5 Live, over the last 3 or 4 years, there's more and more and more sport. The sport is crowding out all of the news. That channel was set up actually during the first Gulf War to be a 24-hour rolling news radio show. It wasn't designed to be a sport programme at all. But over the years, the management have increased the amount of sport. Okay, so you might say, what's the problem with sport? Sport's great, we love it, you know, love to. There's all sorts of problems with sport coverage on TV and radio, in my view. In that, first of all, it encourages this kind of spectator mentality. It's like you're in the stadium looking down on something, you're just watching, you're not participating. Now, sport, football, if you ask me about football, I wouldn't mind if I could manage to not break my leg or get completely worn out in the first 5 minutes. To play football, great, but not to sit and watch it. And in fact, this is my whole feeling towards sport is about this idea of, look, participate. Yeah? Don't just be a spectator, participate if you're going to get involved in sport. So every time there's some kind of sport commentary comes on, switch it off and go down the local park and play a game or something. Now, it's increasing all the time. And in fact, it sounds ridiculous sometimes. I mean, this is me on my little hobby horse, really. But you'll hear a story, which is a massively important story, and it's cut short because there's some lie, there's someone scored a goal somewhere, or there's been a rugby try, and it just sounds ridiculous. And you can tell sometimes with the tone of voice of the presenters that they really resent the way that sport is forcing important stories and important contributors, maybe on the phone or whatever, off the air. And also the other thing that the BBC are doing is they are replacing journalists with sports journalists on 5 Live. So when somebody is off on holiday, instead of getting a journalist, like someone like Victoria Derbyshire, you'll get, I think the guy's name is Stephen Nolan, who's a sportsman, you know? And he's trying to do these hard-hitting interviews with news stories. In fact, what he is a sports journalist. He shouldn't be there at all. He should be covering the sport, you know? So sport is being used like a Trojan horse to just dumb down the amount of news that we're able to hear and see on TV and radio. The other thing is new technology, because many of us have been watching Rupert Murdoch, gleefully watching him wince at all this horrible stuff to do with the evil things he's been doing. And I mean, that's the only way to describe the idea of hacking into people's phones who are dead or dying, and then getting a campaign going around some particular story, and then hacking into the phone of the woman that you're supposed to be on the same side as. I mean, the 7/7 bombing victims and their families' phones being hacked. This is, I mean, not only is this a criminal, and the guy should be behind bars, of course, the entire News of the World team should be behind bars, this is also totally immoral. But the new technology was brought in, first of all, in this country by Rupert Murdoch. And you might say, well, of course it had to happen. Well, it did have to happen at some point. But people don't understand what we lost when computers came into the newspaper industry. There used to be a relationship between journalists and printers, right? I've spoke to quite a lot of old-timers that used to work in those days. And what would happen was, in our local paper in Bristol, for example, you type a story, you type it out on your typewriter, and then you take it down to a compositor. The compositor had a thing called a linotype machine, which was like a giant typewriter, enormous great thing, and as he typed that story in, each of those keys, it wasn't like an ordinary typewriter key, it would fit a letter into a page, a metal letter in reverse, into what they called the form, which was the thing that actually went on the printing machine. And actually, the process of journalist to newspaper was just involved one person, that was the printer, and really not the editor. The editor may have a look at the story, but the editor was there really much more to just steer the journalists into which stories they should be covering. Once a journalist had written a story, he would take the story, direct it to a printer, the printer would then put it in the page. Now, you don't need to be a genius to work out that doesn't really happen anymore. And there are people in between the system now, between the journalist writing and pressing submit before it actually appears on a piece of metal and goes into a printing machine. You know, the editor is hovering around often at that point to see what the newspaper's looking like before it actually goes onto the printing machine. And just to give you one example of that, the 7/7 London bombings. On the day itself, the Guardian sent a reporter down to their Edgware Road tube station, where there's just been a hideous bomb, a blown up tube train. A lot of the victims had come out, Edgware Road tube station, and they were sitting in a Marks and Spencer's recovering, some of them, you know, covered with dust, soot, and blood. And Mark Honigsbaum was that guy. He was sent down by the Guardian to do that. He spoke to various people, was making notes. He was one of the first journalists on the scene. And after about half an hour of speaking to all these victims that had come out of the tube train, he went across the road to a pub, and he recorded a podcast for the Guardian website, so that they could be one of the first people with the story. Now, that podcast says twice, if anyone has ever heard it, I'm not sure, but in that podcast he says twice that after he'd spoken to the people who were on the train, they were all quite clear, the bombs were underneath the trains. And that was submitted about 2 hours after the bomb went off, around about 11 o'clock in the morning. The bombs underneath the trains, he says it twice on that podcast. Only funny thing is that in the Guardian newspaper the next day, there's a story by Mark Honigsbaum saying that the bombs were inside the trains. So about probably a month after the 7/7 bombings, I phoned up Mark Honigsbaum and I said to him, "Mark, there seems to be a slight anomaly between what you said on the podcast and what was in the newspaper. Can you please explain it?" And there was a silence, a pause on the phone. I think, you know, you realise I asked quite. I said, "Well, Tony, all I can say is not everything I submit as copy ends up in the next day's newspaper." So that's one of the things that's changed with the introduction of computer technology into our newspapers. That relationship between the printer and the journalist is gone. The other thing, big thing that's changed, is the changing of deadlines to submit stories. I mean, I've never worked in newspaper journalism, but I know quite a few newspaper journalists. They will tell you that far from the deadlines for stories being extended because of this technology, actually they have to submit their stories considerably earlier in the day. Now, in the old days, you could even do these, people are old enough to remember the stop press. You'd sometimes get in a newspaper a stop press column. This is the old-fashioned system before computers came in. And whilst the newspaper print run was going on, whilst the machines were running printing the newspaper, you could even have a story would be slotted into the side of the machine, and it would go right into the machine, and then it would start being printed in the page while the whole thing was running, while the press was running. So that was the way they used to do things. Say, for example, a story came in very late. It would be on the side of the back page, or possibly on a little space saying stop press on the front page. You'd see an extra story would appear in that paper. And that was stuff which used to happen anything up to like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning as the newspapers are being printed, the daily papers. Not the evening papers, obviously, but the daily papers. Nowadays, journalists will tell you they have to submit their copy, not by the old 9 o'clock standard deadline, for a daily paper, or 10 o'clock sometimes, but now it's generally 6 o'clock. So there's massive delay. This is totally counterintuitive. If you've got this technology, you would think that you would have to submit your, you could submit your story later and later, because it's all really snazzy now. We can, press a button, it makes a page, and then it goes to the printing machine. But no, it's totally the opposite, it's true. So you've got to get your story in way before the old-fashioned system. I'd quite like to see if there was a national newspaper that still used one of these, linotype machines. You might actually find it was really more cutting-edge newspaper, because it would be doing stories which were only on the web, say in The Guardian or in The Independent. So someone might, take that up and use that as a business opportunity to launch a national newspaper, maybe. The other thing is, I mean, we talked briefly about taboos. Another taboo is Freemasonry. When was the last time anyone saw a story about Freemasonry in the national press? Very, very few. The Guardian is one of the few papers which prints stories about Freemasonry. And of course, Freemasonry is a massive network, particularly within the police and within the criminal justice system. Very important. And it affects us. It's just because people are afraid of it, scared of it, self-censorship. Also, it's a very secretive organisation, and very few journalists understand it, how it works. I mean, I've been lucky over the years, having had contacts who are former Freemasons who can talk very openly about it. Now, I'm not saying that Freemasonry is totally bad, but it's something we don't see analysed whatsoever, except occasionally by people like Nick Davis. Now, Nick's Guardian... Another thing I want to say at this point about The Guardian, I'm sounding like I'm a bit too much of a fan of The Guardian, but they are organised in a different way to other newspapers. It's run by something called the Scott Trust, which was started after industrial disturbances in the 1800s. The Scott Trust is run much more like a sort of cooperative or collective, where the editor is chosen by the staff rather than by a boss or a manager, which is why The Guardian has got a slightly different character to other newspapers. Nick Davis is a freelance based in Brighton who writes for The Guardian, and he's come out with this. I don't know if everyone has ever come across this, but this is a brilliant analysis of what's wrong with our media in this country, called Flat Earth News. Exposes falsehood, distortion and propaganda in the global media. I'll just give you a little extract from it. This is to do with Libya. There is a separate evidence of MI6 feeding misleading information to the press in the case of the Sunday Telegraph and Colonel Gaddafi's son. On the 26th of November 1995, the paper's chief foreign correspondent, Tom Coughlin, ran a story describing Gaddafi's son Saif as an untrustworthy maverick and accusing him of being involved in an attempt to flood Iran with fake currency. The story described a complex plot and claimed it had been foiled by Egyptian banking authorities. Saif sued, and after several years of legal argument, the case finally came to trial in April 2002, trailing with it the disclosure. The story had been concocted and provided to the Sunday Telegraph by, guess who? MI6. So MI6 and Con Coughlin are writing whatever they feel like writing and getting it straight into our national newspapers. This is done through something called IOPS, Information Operations. It's a department of MI6, which this is what they spend all their time doing. I mean, I've no idea how many people actually work in this department of MI6, but that's such arrogance that they know that they can write something sitting up in their military intelligence headquarters, and they know for sure it's going to be in the next day's newspapers. I find that absolutely unacceptable, that the military are concocting a lie about things that are going on in the world, and they can just click their fingers and it's in the newspaper the next day. So that's just one example. Another example about, before we totally get off the story of Freemasons, is the connection between Freemasonry, if you find it, and the phone hacking story. There's a fantastic story a few months ago, 8th of June 2011, Nick Davis, Guardian. Phone hacking scandal, Jonathan Rees obtained information using dark arts. Now that's the kind of thing I actually like to see in newspapers, the dark arts being used here. The forces of darkness. I'd like to see more of that kind of, you know, because I think we're dealing with some pretty dark actors. I mean, this is what David Kaye said, wasn't it? Dark actors playing games. Years ago, Jonathan Rees became a Freemason, he says. According to the journalists and investigators who worked with him, he then exploited his link with the lodges to meet Masonic police officers who illegally sold him information which he peddled to Fleet Street. As one of Britain's most prolific merchants of secrets, Rees expanded his network of sources by recruiting, as his business partner, Sid Fillery, a detective sergeant from the Metropolitan Police. Fillery added more officers to their network. Rees also boasted of recruiting corrupt customs officers, a corrupt VAT inspector, and two corrupt bank employees. Now, what we've got here is a criminal conspiracy going on in Scotland Yard to do with, well, obviously, the newspapers and including our customs service. You know, these kind of people should, to my mind, be arrested and, you know, prosecuted. But for whatever reason, it doesn't seem they are. And that's a Masonic lodge, Masonic connections, being the perfect place to actually organise crime and to concoct criminal conspiracy. But probably most importantly, I don't know if people have seen this book before. Apparently copies of it are being stolen from libraries around the country because there was only a print run of 5,000 done. And be sold on eBay. But I managed to get this for like 15 quid or something. But apparently it's going for like anything up to £300-400 a copy of this book. This is written by two journalists, Michael Gillard and Laurie Flynn. And Michael Gillard, who I interviewed about a couple of months ago, he used to work as a producer and a researcher on World in Action. People will remember that, the old days of real television investigative journalism. And what they've done really here is show that there are criminal networks in Scotland Yard who are protecting each other. Now, funnily enough, he actually names the Untouchables in here. He's got given, and none of them have sued them. I'll give you some of the names of these Untouchables. Ian Blair. Andy Heyman. John Yates. Now, they're on the list here of the Untouchables. I mean, he goes through some incredible stories to do with serious corruption. And he does go, at some points, into Masonic connections as well. But it's quite clear that the criminals in this country gravitate towards the police. And it seems that they find in some, particularly the higher echelons of the police, in London, in the Met particularly, they find they're welcome with open arms. For example, it's similar to the city. It's like a sort of revolving doors. What's his second name? There's a guy who was a part of a criminal gang in London who was prosecuted by Margaret Thatcher. I'm trying to think of his second name. Charlie Richardson. He was famous for throwing electric fires into the bath. He'd get people, he'd put them in the bath, and he'd threaten to throw an electric fire in the bath if he didn't pay up. And the other thing he would do is get bolt croppers and chop your toes off, yeah, if you didn't pay up. He was a sort of Cray Brothers style character. Anyway, under Harold Wilson, he was finally, this is back in the 70s, he was finally jailed for something like 5 or 6 years. When he came out of jail, he was offered a job in the City of London. And these are the kinds of characters that, you know, ruthless people that seem to be being recruited by the financial elite and also by the cops. Another thing which is really not discussed, which should be, is this whole concept of false flag terrorism. The idea that you can blow up a bomb, kill innocent people, and then blame it on some dark-skinned person. This is a very normal practice by our intelligence services, and our police seem to turn a complete blind eye to the possibility that someone may not be a suicide bomber. I mean, if you go back to the Shia insurgency in Iraq, for example, the whole thing kicked off after something called the Al-Sadr newspaper was closed down by the Americans. This newspaper was a weekly paper that had been going out all over Iraq for several years, and they printed a front page story saying there was, this is a 2004, 2005, I can't remember the exact date, but they printed a front page story saying suicide bomber was in fact helicopter missile. Right? Because what they've done is they've got 20 or 30 eyewitnesses to a bomb attack in Baghdad, which had been reported around the world as a suicide bombing. Now they managed to arrange loads of eyewitnesses to the story who all testified that actually it was not a suicide bombing at all, it was a helicopter firing a missile into a bus queue. And the week after they published that story, the American troops turned up outside the newspaper, padlocked the gates in the morning, and told them that, sorry, your newspaper's now closed. And that just after that was when the insurgency started in Iraq. So you can see that there's this kind of, the Shia insurgency. Yeah. So you can see there's a complete denial over the idea that when a bomb attack happens, or when a terrorist outrage happens, or when any kind of outrage happens, you just have to simply accept what you're told in the news about who's to blame. And there's really very little questioning of it. Now, from my mind, I actually wrote a piece for the Journalist magazine about this whole idea of suicide bombing. You know, someone can slip a bomb in your pocket. Someone can stick a bomb in your bag. If that bomb blows you up, you might just like to be called a suicide bomber. How do you tell whether it was someone actually, you know, voluntarily did this deliberately? It's really, there's no actual analysis of this whole business. Now, we're coming up for probably, you know, towards the end. What I'd like to do is just read out a list of stories, I suppose, to do with things which we aren't really told much about, and just run through a few, and I'd like, if you could just, at the end of it, maybe, I'll read through them twice, remember we do it like this, I'll read through them twice, then a second time, put your hand up if you think you want to hear more about that, and then we'll do a bit more in depth into that particular story. You with me?
How many votes?
Right. You got one, you only put your hand up once, yeah? But I'll read through them first once to begin with. Okay, story number one, Britain and the United States lost 3 nuclear weapons each, and David Cameron was the dealer. Story number two. The Nazis escape in 1944, who tried to kill Hitler. They wanted to try and end the war early, but their submarine was destroyed by the US Navy before they could end the war. We could talk about the police and how if the police now were to take the exams that the police used to do in the 1950s, only 10% of them would pass. There's been 2 arrests recently at Windsor Castle because it's quite clear that there's a paedophile ring in Windsor Castle. This mad Norwegian guy that went around shooting people in the Labour from the Labour Party, the young people in the Labour Party in Norway, and his very close links to the English Defence League and the far right and Knights Templar in Britain. And it certainly doesn't look like he was acting alone. Certainly in his motivation, anyway. We could talk about the Bilderberg group, the conferences of the Bilderbergs, which I've done quite a lot of, you know, sort of primary research on. There's also Sun Valley, which is where a lot of the world's media meet up in secret every year in the US. Or, I suppose, we could talk about the Illuminati, which is, from my point of view anyway, a historical fact, an organisation which was set up in the late 1700s with the object of taking over power, in particularly all over Europe, over potentially hundreds of years. Okay, so you've heard those stories. I'll run through them again once more. And you
you're
can
never
going
to leave, Tony.
You can just tell me. We can't do them all. We can't do them all.
We either want to read the options and I'll put the hands up.
Okay. Okay, so the UK and the US, do you want to adjudicate here?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. The US and the US, the UK and the US lost 3 nuclear weapons each and David Cameron was involved. Some Nazis tried to kill Hitler in July 1944, but the Americans bombed their attempt to stop the war early.
They've seen the Tom Cruise movie. I'm not sure you can buy him.
Not too many of them. Yeah. The police and the fact that they can't do exams very well nowadays as they used to. No, okay. Windsor Castle, paedophile ring. See, the interesting thing about stories like that is it's just a tiny little column. I don't know. Put your hands up if you actually read that story anywhere.
Yes, I read.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hardly any. But this is a major story in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Was that in the Sun?
I don't know.
I saw something like that in the Sun.
This is one of the.
Okay, anyway, before we finish, yeah, let's just get through the list. Anders Breivik and the English Defence League. Yeah, okay. Not so interesting. The Bilderbergs. Yeah. Is it interesting how, you know, this none of this stuff really gets properly discussed, does it? Sun Valley and the secret meetings of Murdoch on the big media of the world in the US.
Okay.
And finally, the good old friends of ours, the Illuminati. From 1700s, by the way. There's none of them around now. Okay, so what's the our result?
There was about 3 there between 9 and 11. So you've created a massive dichotomy.
Come on, be decisive. Yeah,
come on. I think we put it as a bit of Bilderberg, and I think it is interesting that they've just met and that the agendas that 3 or 4 years ago were taking place about Iraq and Iran and Yemen, they're sort of coming to fruition. So it might be helpful to have a little bit of a summary of that. Whether we do 10 minutes now and then have a break.
Okay. Well, look, why don't we just do a little bit about the Bilderbergs and then do the story properly, which I think was most people were saying, which was Cameron and the nuclear weapons.
Yes.
I mean, is that...
A little tiny bit about
the Bilderbergs is, first of all, again, Masonic. There's a lot of connections between Bilderberg and Freemasonry. And this is one of the things that, I've kind of been surprised as I've been digging this stuff out. Just going through it as a standard journalistic practice, researching it, you find, for example, that the guy that started it, Joseph Rechinger, he was really the main man behind it. He was working for MI6. He was a Polish Freemason. The other thing is, the last Bilderberg meeting that took place in the British Isles, the Turnberry meeting, the main organiser for that meeting was also the personal assistant to the Duke of Kent, who's the head of World Freemasonry. And more recently, Peter Carrington, Lord Carrington, who was the chairman of Bilderberg for something like 7 or 8 years, maybe actually a bit longer than that, he also was a Freemason. So a lot of important Masonic connections into the Bilderberg conferences. But I think the most important thing with the Bilderbergs to discuss, and it'd be nice to maybe have a couple of questions as well, is the way that it's starting to break into the mainstream press through people like Charlie Skelton in the Guardian website as a great comedy writer going over there and really sending them up. And I think in this sort of situation, when you find something which is a taboo, the Bilderberg clearly is a taboo, if people just don't want to talk about it because it's more than their job's worth, etc., humour cuts through all that crap. And Charlie's done a fantastic job over the last 3 years now in actually doing good mainstream press reports on it. You know, I've tried myself over the years to phone up news desks, say, look, you know, let's get something in about the Bilderberg this year. You haven't done it before. You know who they are. Quite often they're on national news, we don't. But that is absolutely tied to NATO. And we all know what NATO's up to around the world, in Afghanistan and Libya and places like this. This is really, I think it's fair to say, a political public relations influence campaign from NATO. So I think NATO is setting the agenda. It's not that Bilderberg decides things. The more secretive military objectives are set, and political objectives are set by NATO. Bilderberg is there as a kind of massive schmooze fest to get the kings and queens, and to really to get, I mean, a good example is Will Hutton, who used to be the editor of The Observer. He went along to one of these Bilderberg conferences, and he's now doing some quite good analysis of the financial crisis, but he clearly wasn't impressed with their economic analysis, and he backed off. With John Smith, he made it very clear at the time, this is the former Labour leader, when he went to the Bilderberg conference, that he didn't like what they were talking about, and I've heard from sources that he was kicking up a fuss. Basically, he wanted to bring other economists who were going to tell them that they were talking rubbish along to the next Bilderberg meeting. This is about 1992-1993. Unfortunately, by the time the next Bilderberg meeting took place, John Smith was dead. Died of a heart attack. And Tony Blair was invited along the year before he became the leader of the Labour Party instead of Smith. So, you know, I would suggest that the Bilderberg, really what they're doing is they're being like kingmakers. It doesn't matter which way we vote, the Bilderbergers are doing everything they possibly can to get their placemen ready to take over as a leader of the opposition or as a prime minister. So do you want to have some questions on the Bilderberg? Any questions people have got?
And you just said NATO is running the show.
Yeah.
Can you explain a bit more about that?
Well, if you look at the Bilderberg, the lists of who comes to the Bilderberg meetings, they're almost all coming from the NATO countries. We've seen a bit of a change this particular year because they've invited some of the Chinese. But it's the NATO countries which these people come from. Say, for example, the Russians. For a long time, apparently, the Russians were moaning, saying, look, we want to come along to these. Yeah, we think it's important. And what they did eventually is they started inviting people from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace office in Moscow, who of course, are not really Russian. They're American. It's all run by the Americans. So they're saying, oh, look, we've invited a Russian. But, of course, he isn't a Russian. He's an American Russian. It's NATO, the NATO countries. I mean, I even got a phone call once when I was sitting in a cafe in Gloucester Docks from Malawi's presidential office to my phone. They'd seen my website, Bilderberg.org, and obviously said someone, the president of Malawi, wanted to come along to a Bilderberg meeting. It wasn't him I spoke to, it was his personal assistant. But I said, look, there's no way. Because it's the NATO country.
Yeah. That's phone jacket, that
is. Since I'm Tommy Gosling, I'd like to attend the Bilderberg.
But so it is absolutely tied in with NATO, quite clearly. And I think people are familiar with Thierry Masson did a really good piece this year, at the time of the, just before the Bilderberg conference this year, absolutely spelling that out. So if you go onto the Voltaire Network on the internet, you'll see all about that. Now, you have had your hand up.
I was just going to say, is the Bilderberg group and the Illuminati, is it, the, you know, like the Skull and Crossbones section of the Illuminati, the Bilderberg group, like a Pacific, I don't know, like they all went to a certain school, or they all went to a certain sort of criteria to be in that elite section of the Freemasons?
No, I think it's a Masonic, the Masonic is involved in organisation, right, in the actual organisation. But what they do is they invite people, as I said, like Will Hutton along, to say, well, look, you know, here's the Queen of the Netherlands, here's, you know, whoever, Evelyn de Rothschild, here's David Rockefeller. You know, who are you to argue with them? These people really run, you know, the entire financial system in the world. The idea is, I think, to sort of persuade people that maybe they're on the wrong track, and it's about schmoozing people, saying, come on our, you know, come on our way of doing things, and come around to our way of thinking. And it's actually a very powerful
people are invited and given a kind of briefing before they go on there, a little briefing of what this is what we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, and they're told you're not allowed to talk You can talk about what you heard here. It's all done under Chatham House rules, which is a whole other story, the Chatham House Law Institute for International Affairs. Right? But the Chatham House rules means you can talk about what you heard there, but you're never allowed to name anybody that you spoke to or tell the press where you heard about it. So these Chatham House rules are used quite a lot, I'm afraid, in public affairs. I've been to certain meetings in Bristol where they tell you, this is all under Chatham House rules. Yeah? You're not allowed to quote anybody by name. You're not allowed to say to any press or anybody where you heard what you heard. So the idea is to try and make these networks invisible. Now, thank God, due to the internet mainly, and due to some really good researchers in different parts of the world, many people, anybody that really wants to understand what Bilderberg's about can now do so. They can look at the origins of it, and they can look at the individuals involved, and they can look at the kind of agenda that's going on there. So any more? You want another one on the Bilderberg?
Yeah, yeah? Getting back to NATO, who in NATO is setting the agenda then? I mean, it's the kings and queens and...
It's intelligence services. Financial.
Who put them in charge of
it? I would also argue that you've actually got a kind of shadow government going on within NATO, where you've got the private military companies, who I would suggest something like 9/11, the big operation. I don't believe there's many people here that would say that the 9/11 official story is true. But in which case, who actually planned 9/11? I would say probably think people like these private military companies like Blackwater. I mean, if you go onto Blackwater XE, whatever you want to call its website, they actually say, we are one of the best organisations in the world to fight a nuclear war. We've got all the information, we've got all the computers to actually do the fighting. Come to us. And it's a privatisation of, you know, we started with privatisation of land, didn't we? Everything's being privatised. Our genetic material is being privatised. War is being privatised. And of course, war, as we know, can be very, very profitable. So these, I think, are the people. Once you get the private military companies and the big oil companies and the world's financial system into something like NATO and through the Bilderberg into our political system, you've got a very, very dangerous beast you're dealing with. That are actually there to cause death and mayhem for profit, and they're making a lot of money at the moment out of fear and out of killing people.
Didn't George Osborne have a conflict of interest with Bilderberg? Didn't he have that thing where he was paid to go? I mean,
One of the things that came out this year, Bilderberg for years have said it's a private meeting. It's just a private meeting. Right. And, you know, nobody really believes that. Do they? But they say it nevertheless. When we went to this hotel in, I'm thinking the last one I went to, in Belgium, they were actually putting out that it was a croquet tournament. You know, they'll come up with any kind of rubbish.
Yeah, this is a life existence.
But actually, it's much more serious than that. And George Osborne was there with his Treasury team. Charlie managed to find that out. So it's quite clear that he is there in an official capacity at a secret meeting with the world's financial elite. I mean, he's obviously a member of the Bullingdon Club, which is a weird kind of, almost an equivalent to our Skull and Bones, a sort of university fraternal society where these young thugs are told, yeah, you just toe the line and we're going to make you Prime Minister. You know, this is quite a dangerous way to run a country. It certainly ain't democratic.
We'll do one more question.
From somebody else. Anyone else with a question on the Bilderbergs? No. So go on, you again then.
Yeah. Benjamin Fulford's been saying some interesting things. Have you heard much about that?
I do know. I've heard a bit of Ben Fulford. He claims to be his ex-Forbes guy, isn't he, from Japan?
That's right.
What's he said? Let's just throw it out.
Okay, he's had a meeting with 57 international financiers in international waters where they're issuing an ultimatum to the global elite, telling them to cease and desist, own up to their crimes in a truth and reconciliation type meeting, and giving them an and one of the things that happened was that there was an earthquake just registered near Washington, D.C. and Denver, Colorado, and the evidence seems to indicate that those were underground bases that were destroyed. And it was done by an organization called White Dragon, which he is a spokesperson for. And so they're telling the elite, you've got an opportunity now to own up to your crimes, and we'll forgive you your crimes. Otherwise, we're going to start coming after you.
I know, he was threatening them with setting the ninjas on them, wasn't he?
That's
what he was, man. So, anyway, I think it is worth mentioning the Illuminati in that I am very sceptical about using the term Illuminati to describe people like Kenneth Clark, Peter Mandelson, etc. Because of the tainted use of the term by so many people, anything weird that happens, like an earthquake, people say, oh, it's the Illuminati. You know, Fukushima happens, oh, it's the Illuminati. This is really, you know, quite a dangerous way to go if you're trying to get stories into the mainstream press. So I always stick to the two best books, I think, on the Illuminati, which were written in the 18th century. One is by John Robison, called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe. And in the title, it explains the Illuminati's original aims, which are to infiltrate and take over all mainstream religions. Obviously, that includes Christianity, Judaism, Islam, you know, look at the Vatican, for example, and Hinduism, all these religions. That was what their objective was at that time, quite clearly, to infiltrate these earthly superstructures of these religions. And I mean, I don't think you need to be a genius to work out that Tony Blair and George Bush were not following the teachings of Jesus Christ, for example. So that's one side of it, and in a way, that's your heart. So the other aspect was infiltrating the political system, which is political parties throughout Europe. That's what they spelled out in their own writing. John Robison is worth reading, particularly because he's a great writer. Also, he was a very senior figure at the time. He was himself a Freemason who could see his Masonic organisation in the late 1800s being taken over by really ruthless people. And so he writes from a Masonic point of view, which in a way makes the whole thing more fascinating. He was also a close personal friend of James Watt, who played a big role in the Industrial Revolution by inventing the steam engine. There's just been an exhibition in London about, you know, he was a mate of James Watt. He himself was credited with the invention of the siren, believe it or not. Remember, imagine World War II and the Blitz. This is John Robison's invention, warning people that the Nazis are coming. You know, in a way, there's something incredible kind of figurative power in the guy that invented the siren. Also, writing a book for us to read now from the 1800s about the Illuminati. Very powerful stuff and very well written. Because he was a speaker of several European languages, fluent speaker, and he'd taken the trouble as a Mason to go round Europe collecting leaked material from the Illuminati, because stuff had been written about them and was leaked. He translated it all into English and published it here in Britain and in other parts of the world as well. There's another book as well, which isn't quite so well written, but that's by a guy called Abbe Barrowell, which is called Code of the Illuminates, which goes into a lot of the initiation rites the Illuminati used. Now, this is all leaked material, source material from the late 1800s. That's why I like it. And I think if we want to understand what the Illuminati are, they're not causing every natural disaster. They are a formal Masonic organisation set up all that time ago. So, shall we just finish there and have a bit of a break?
Yeah, I think we're polite. Rip off.